show your mom. You know, I speak for the fans in a lot of ways. I know how they feel. They're great. They're loyal. They want a bang for their buck.
We know how you feel because we feel the same way too. This is Sportsnet 650, home of the Canucks. My name is Dr. Tej Dhaliwal, and I'm joined by Sat Oberoi, Nav Desange, and Ryan Cattermole. We are the Larshcast.
Hold up. Hold up. Hold up. Hope you're ready for the next episode. Hey.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to this May 8th edition of the Larshcast on Sportsnet. I am Ryan Cattermole here with Sat Oberoi, Joey Pitts, producer Joel Gaudette, and TJ will be joining us shortly once he finishes a quick computer update, so hopefully he'll be on fairly quickly as well. But
that's what happens when you click remind me later.
Oh, that's what I'm saying, man. How many times did that guy click the remind me later? Because personally, on my MacBook right now, I'm sitting at like a month and a half without updates. So, you know, it is what it is. At some point, I'm going to be hit with that as well, too, and it happens to the best of us. But we had a pretty darn eventful week in the hockey world, with a whole bunch of people angry about a whole bunch of things this last week. And we also have just an absolutely jam-packed show today, guys. I don't know about you, but I'm stoked about this one. At 10 o'clock, we've got John Forslund, Kraken play-by-play TV broadcast. That's a bit of a tongue twister. 10:30, we got Stacey Jo Rost. 11 o'clock, we got Joey Kenward. And I'm pretty stoked for this one, guys. At 11:40, being that I'm a musician myself as well, too, we got Aaron Pritchett on, country singer, songwriter, number one hit superstar, Canucks Country Rocks organizer, and honorary Canucks alumni. So it's going to be an absolutely jam-packed show. But Joey, I'm going to start with you here today because you had a pretty eventful week this last week. You want to tell the folks what you got up to on Wednesday?
Well, I made my play-by-play debut in the BCHL when the Cranbrook Bucks took on the Trail Smoke Eaters. I talked about it briefly on last week's show, bringing it up. I plugged it a bit, got a hard time about it from everybody at the rink when I showed up on Monday. Like, wow, you're really putting yourself over. You're going to try to get a simulcast on 650 now because you're such a big shot.
I heard it all. Over. Little wrestling
reference.
Oh, yeah, put
myself over. Always, always. I dress myself in $5,000 cashmere. Sorry. No, it went really well. It went really well. The only thing I can say is it was a 1-0 final, so I would have liked to have a little bit more happen. Last night's game was a rematch between Cranbrook and Trail. Cranbrook overcame a 3-0 deficit in 3 minutes. Trail scored again at the end of the second. Cranbrook tied it with 30 seconds left and won it with 8 seconds left. The best game of the pod all season. Okay. And I was back behind the PA microphone for it, not calling that game. So it's kind of painful, but...
Isn't that always the way? Well, you mentioned the low-scoring game, and I think that's what the Canucks are going to hope to do against Edmonton here tonight. But I know, Sat, we got a poll question about that very thing, keeping a said superstar off the scoreboard here.
Yeah,
so do you want to tee that up for us?
Yeah, for sure. Our poll question here on the Larshcast this morning is, how many points will Connor McJesus McDavid score tonight versus the Canucks? So, if the background there, he's got 96 points on the season, and it's a race, it's a watch to 100. So we got four options. A is pretty simple. Will he get 1 point today versus the Canucks? B, will he get two? Three, will he get three? Or C, will he get three? Or D, 4 points. Get to the century mark. 100 points, baby. So you know what? My money is probably in the 2 or 3 points, but I would love to see him get that fourth point tonight. And just to, you know, it's a Canucks thing, right? All these milestones seem to happen against the Canucks. So why can't his century mark in a shortened season happen against the Canucks?
No, it will. It will. Like, look back historically through all the big moments in NHL history. There's a good chance they happened against the Canucks. Gretzky scored more goals against Richard Brodeur than he did against any goalie. He got his 802nd against McLean. Everything that happens in this league tends to happen against the Canucks. Mm-hmm. Remember, Evgeny Nabokov scored a goal in 2002. That was against the Canucks.
What a reference.
Yeah, there you go.
Evgeny working his Nabokov. Shout out to Don Taylor.
Does anybody else laugh? Good morning, boys, by the way. But does anybody else laugh when Joey just goes down history row and just like...
I love doing this.
How does he pull this out?
Well, it's the best because like most of this stuff is pre his birth. So,
well, that's I was four when Nabokov scored that goal. Okay, oh, I wasn't yet watching hockey. Was all in on the WWF by that point, but.
Did your mom and dad read you like NHL history books when you were young?
Yeah. I remember you guys
instead of the ABCs, you got Bobby Orr Gretzky's.
Yeah, well, it was always you guys always gave me the hard times. Like, how do you know so much about all this old stuff? Well, like simply put, my dad was cooler than yours. I'm sorry, I'm not saying that just to everybody in the call, except for you, Joel. I'm also saying that to all the listeners. Father, Jim Pitt, is just cooler than your dad. I'm sorry, it's just how it works.
So I got a question then. I got a question for you, Joey.
Okay.
So you know so much about hockey. Do you remember who the backup goalie was for the Sharks then? You probably
That would have been Mika Kiprusoff.
Was it Kiprusoff?
That would have been Mika Kiprusoff, and their third stringer would have been Vesa Toskala.
I was going to
say Toskala. Toskala, there it
wasn't,
is.
Wasn't Toskala like the next big thing when he went to Toronto, right? He went to Toronto after.
Let in a bunch of goals from center ice.
Like, the way it worked is they decided to hold on to Toskala over Kiprusoff as the backup of the future.
Clearly
to take over from Nabokov, and they shipped Kiprusoff to Calgary. And in his first year in Calgary, he, like, set Flames records and took him to the Cup Final. So, you know.
I hated Mika Kiprusoff. Like, every time you saw that... You know, he always takes his mask off after every whistle.
He does have a bit of
immediately,
a sour face.
Yeah, he takes it and just look at that. And his smug look when he makes a good save stays so calm, but he's got that smug look. You just want
and he was so good.
Face.
He was so good, too.
Oh, he's so good, yeah, absolutely.
He barely smoked like a chimney, too, right? So
really?
Apparently, yeah. So I just expected him to light one up after, too.
Ready for Cigar Aficionado interview with Mika Kiprusoff.
So wow. I heard you guys talking about Connor McDavid and the ridiculous...
I was just going to ask. Can you answer the poll question, TJ? What are your thoughts over here?
I would not be shocked if he gets 4 points tonight. He's got 9 in 3 games so far in this set. But
and
this
he's only had one good game, like actually one good game.
He's not even playing that well right now, and he's still like at a 1.7 point.
The thing that's
pace.
Most ridiculous about what he's doing this year is he's got a 19-point lead on second place,
which
and 30 points, yeah, on Draisaitl, and a 30-point lead ahead of the rest of the elite pack, where you know start off with Marner, and then it's like everybody's got a point or a point a 2-point difference there. It's insane what McDavid is doing this year, and I think Jay Fresh Hockey kind of put it to bed about the weakness between the divisions being a reason why McDavid is thriving. If you look at the comparables across the divisions, everybody's got about the same goals for and the same goals against every division. So you can't really attribute what he's doing to the division being weaker.
He's just the best.
He's having a career year. He's in his prime. You know, will he ever win a cup? I don't know, but... If I'm going to bet on any time for McDavid to win a cup, this year might be the year to do it.
Yeah, that's the problem, though, right, TJ? Is like, you know, you mentioned how all the divisions are really close in terms of their statistical, you know, analysis of the goals for or goals against. But on Edmonton, it's just so astronomically geared towards McDavid.
Yeah.
And Draisaitl being the drivers of that
and
offense. Like, the team is not good without
one
of them.
No, that team is terrible.
Yeah,
McDavid has the
so
same
strange.
Number of points. He has the same number of points as Hoglander, Horvat, and Miller combined.
Yeah,
that's
crazy.
Insane. Like,
it's crazy, so, but I wonder what the Canucks' like top 6 point scoring would be if you just took out, or I guess let's say 3 to 6 would be if you took out the top 2 on each team. That'd be a good comparison to make. I haven't done that, but.
Yeah, no, it'd be interesting to see. So let me put it to you guys this way then, because I kind of did the math last night here. If it was an 82-game season, McDavid, at the pace he's at right now, assuming he only makes it to 100 goals, he would have been sitting at about 150 points for a regular full-length season. So my question is, where do you guys rank this against, you know, what Gretzky has done previously, albeit in a different league? Because I would argue this could be the most spectacular offense or performance we've seen out of an NHL player ever, given the era that he's playing in. So I don't know, Joey, what are your thoughts first on that? Do you agree, disagree?
Well, it's hard because there was some really good offensive explosions from certain players in the late 90s, early 2000s at the height of that trap style. Like to bring it back to somebody close to home for us, Bure, after he was dealt to Florida, he put up 50 goals in 48 games in 99-2000. Yeah, different. He's shooting on Dominic Hasek and Marty Brodeur. How much different is the league? There was like the expected goals in that season were like 1.9 for the game. Like goaltenders were unreal. Goaltenders have never been better than they were in the late 90s, and that's a controversial take. I don't care. Look at
the
numbers.
Well, it's the Trop era. I think you're right about the numbers, but maybe not the actual individual talent of the goalies.
Yeah,
fair. All right. You want to make that time machine comparison. Right now, Dominik Hasek, take him out from the 99 Sabres and put him on any team in this league.
Put him on the 2021 Sabres.
Yeah. Put him on the 2021 Sabres. Put him on the Sabres right now and tell me that wouldn't make a difference.
Yeah, they would have lost 10 in a row instead of, what, 17 or 18 in a row.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
they would have won 10 in a row. What are you talking about?
Still up for the Vezina.
So Joey's firmly in the no camp on that one. You're saying McDavid's season doesn't compare to what Gretzky and some of those guys like a Barry.
It's definitely impressive, but I would say like even some of the stuff that Ovi did back like 10 years ago, I would say is on par with it. I mean, I don't think it's fair to be like this is on pace with when Gretzky put up 92 goals and 210 points. Like, it's not. Like, are you kidding me? Yeah, sure, 100 points in, 53 games is really impressive.
But 100,
it's not
150-ish
Gretzky
points over an 82-game pace.
I would say
this. That's still 60 points less
TJ,
than Gretzky.
Come on.
I would just say this. It's a damn pandemic, right? Like, this season itself is historical. So under that context, yeah, what McDavid is doing is special. But I can see what Joey's saying, and it's definitely debatable. You know, there's not going to be a concrete answer unless it's statistical, right? And even then, it takes a few years, 5 years before everybody forgets what we went through in this pandemic here. Yeah. And it just becomes a, like, for example, the Tampa Bay Cup win becomes a cup win 10 years from now. It's not viewed as a pandemic season, anything. Anybody who ever had an asterisk to that, it's gone in a few years, right? So
we're going to know next year, right? If McDavid puts up anywhere near 150 points next year, barring injury, then we'll know how impressive it is, because it's just really tough to say now.
The other one to compare is Matthews and his goal scoring right now.
He's scoring at a
historical rate too.
I would say Matthews is almost more impressive than McDavid.
No.
Goal scoring in the National Hockey League is a lot harder than putting up points in the National Hockey League. Okay.
You know what's more impressive?
I could put up points playing on a power play with Leon Draisaitl. Okay. Like, come on, it's not meaning anything. Matthews is scoring goals every game for the Leafs. That's all he does.
He's a defensive black hole.
He's a ringer.
I'll say this.
If you could have a designated hitter in hockey, it'd be Austin Matthews.
Okay, like, hold on.
Oh, here comes Joey. Producer Joel.
Let's back this up here. Okay? Let's back this up here.
Struck up, Joey. Come on now.
You're not actually trying to tell our listeners right now that Austin Matthews is a better player than Connor McDavid?
That's not what you're saying.
Thank you. Please tell me that.
I'm saying he's a better goal scorer. Matthews can actually bury on a break.
He's a one-trick pony, a la Alexander Ovechkin. Like, he can be a great goal scorer, but who would you rather take on your hockey club?
I'm going to pull a quote out from the great Jaromir Jagr. Okay?
Oh, God.
So, if McDavid scored on every breakaway he got, he would finish every season with 300 goals. The dude... his hands cannot keep up with his feet.
If
McDavid can, like, just make it close.
The listener's eyes can't keep up with McDavid.
The great thing about Burre was that his hands were as fast as his feet. McDavid hasn't found that yet, right? I'm not saying that he can't. Maybe he can just learn to slow it down just a little bit to keep his hands there. But until he can really bury on breakaways, which is the prime scoring chance in the National Hockey League. When you're a kid playing road hockey, it's always a breakaway in overtime of Game 7, right?
Yeah.
If McDavid can learn to bury on breakaways consistently, he's the best player in the world, all right? But until then, he's not, because Matthews is a better goal scorer, and you have to have the complete package.
Well, you match a complete package.
I'm not saying Matthews is the complete package.
This isn't
hold
a debate.
On. One last thing I want to say, because I hate giving any Toronto Maple Leaf any type of love, but
it's a hell of a season.
I'll say this: Austin Matthews, like, he can have the puck on his stick for just a fraction of a second. It can be in the back of the net. That's how good he is this year. Like, he's got a goal scoring talent that this year is second to none. Mm-hmm. I would argue Ovechkin in his prime did it a fraction of a second better than Matthews did.
Yeah.
But what Matthews is doing right now is ridiculous. You got to give him some love. And the only reason I give him love is because he's going to be an Arizona Coyote soon. So he's not just going to be a Toronto Maple Leaf.
All right, McDavid's gonna join him when his contract's up. Hey,
let's switch shift this up a for bit. One. No, yeah. no, because Joel has a clip I want to play in. Tee it up, Joel. Joey, I know you guys mentioned it off the hop. You know, Joey did his play-by-play debut in the BCHL, but we actually have a clip of what he was doing there. And Joel, whenever you're ready, go ahead and play it, because this is a beautiful. It's a future voice of the game. Everybody, listen to it.
Here's the chance, throws it across, Zito scores! Kalen Zito on the 3-on-1. A great dish across from Noah Wakeford, and the Smoke Eaters open the scoring.
Love it. He's got that Dave Randorf kind of vibe to him, hey?
Like absolutely, that's a perfect reference.
Well, I'm telling you, you got that same inflection.
They haven't caught up with his voice, his tongue yet. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So
I tried to make a reference to that little comment he made.
No, that's a good point.
But Joey, let's be honest for a second. And once again, you're listening to the LarshCast on Sportsnet 650, home of the Vancouver Canucks, on a Canucks game day against the Edmonton Oilers this afternoon evening. Joey, so have you modeled your kind of inflection, or is he kind of your go-to guy in terms of your pitching and your pacing? Because I know everybody that's coming up on the play-by-play side has a guy they reference as the person they're trying to emulate. Is Dave Randorf yours, or who would yours be?
Well, I kind of pull from a lot of people, right? You know, everybody has their influences. I pull from a lot of hockey guys. I pull from wrestling commentators as well as a couple other places, right? So, I mean, like Shorty and Houston are big for me. Cuthbert as well. I can listen to Chris Cuthbert call games forever. I was so pumped when I found out he was calling all the Canucks games during the playoffs last year. Oh, I was excited. And a side note, he sent me a really nice DM before Christmas just encouraging me, because I was tweeting out how I wrote my entry exam for BCIT about Cuthbert. And somebody sent it to him, and he was just like, hey, I heard that you wrote your thing about me. Good luck. Hope everything goes well. And I was like, oh, that made my Christmas, you know? Like, so I got a little... Right, and then, you know, you pull over to the wrestling side of things, you know, like good old JR Jim Ross, you know, things like that. You get the emotion from it. By God, right? It's broken in half, right? And even then, though, you also go to the other side of things, like you look at like Jay and Dan and stuff like that, and even like Conan O'Brien. Like, the humor that you can have when you do things, right? Because I want to be able to have, like, you know, little... I don't want to say I want to have catchphrases, but, like, I want it to be fun. The best thing about listening to Shorty and Cheech is that you have a blast. Like, it's like watching the game with your buddies, right? Yeah. And I love that about Shorty and Cheech, is that they're hilarious, right? And I kind of want to incorporate that with myself. So, you know, I have a lot of influences. But Randorf's up there, yeah.
No, it's good. So I think we got it. We got a shift here to the big topic this week, hey, Sat?
No, are we going to do that here, or are we going to do that at the 11:30? You know, we come out of, because that's a lot to get into.
Are we going to wait? Because I know I'm going to get heated, and I know.
Let's wait, because I don't want you to cut off in the middle of your, you know, getting heated and everything. So
frankly, I never get angry on this show, guys, and I'm pretty furious about this one.
Maybe we should just let you go right now. Then
it's okay. If
you're angry, I don't.
No,
want
no,
you
no,
to,
no. Let's do this.
If you sit there and let that anger fester, it's gonna get even worse.
You go,
for
Ryan. You go.
Yeah, go ahead, Ryan. Let's get it off your chest.
I do want to talk about just the absolute ridiculousness that we've seen in the NHL this last week, and I think you guys know what I'm talking about. The New York Rangers, Washington Capitals, Tom Wilson fiasco. This guy is the poster child of a repeat offender, and I get it. Like, he messaged after and tried to say some nice things, and I think he realizes genuinely after the moment that what he's done is probably not the right thing. But for the league not to suspend this guy, not to make a point of saying, hey, we're a league that cares about concussions, if you're going to ragdoll a player and people are going to make the argument, oh, he jumped on Wilson's back first, he did this, he did that, doesn't matter. The action of ragdolling a player that doesn't have a helmet on and then proceeding to pick him up and slam him down onto the ice and not give that player suspension is asinine to me. It breeds a culture of unsafety in the NHL. I'd be worried if I was an NHL player. If I've got my helmet on, off, I've got to get to the bench immediately, because they've set a precedent that that sort of behavior is only a $5,000 fine. And yet you see guys like Alex Edler, two games for that knee on knee, and there was a whole bunch of context to that. Now you see, we're having guys suspended for ridiculous things. There's no consistency in the league. And then we have the New York Rangers calling out George Parros. And I'm sorry, I get that the NHL is a league where players and the league staff and anybody that works for a team, you don't question what the league does. But why? Why is that? Maybe it's time for that culture to change. And I'll be the first to say, I'm proud of the New York Rangers for standing up and saying enough is enough, mm-hmm. because we need original six big teams like this to stand up and do it, because the Canucks have done it before. Burrows has done it before in this market. People have stood up and said, hey, the way we are policing this is wrong, and it creates confusion. And what was the result, guys? Six fights in the first 5 minutes of that New York Rangers game. Was it fun to watch? Was it classic hockey? You know, some may say yes, absolutely. Was it dangerous as hell? I love you, Joel.
Circus.
You know, it was an absolute, that's the exact clip. It was a circus. It was a circus. How is not suspending Tom Wilson justification for that sort of behavior?
This is what I was Sat furious. Was
anyways,
last
TJ,
week.
Tell me what your thoughts are.
Well, no, I agree with everything that you're saying, Ryan, and it was very well said. And, you know, going back to last week, Sat was talking about how when it came to the Edler Simmons situation, where the suspension should have taken care of, like, if it was an adequate suspension, it would have taken care of that whole situation, and he wouldn't have had to fight Simmons. Well, that's the thing, Sat, about this situation. When you have a suspension, even for Tom Wilson, does it really take care of it, though? Because their star players out for the rest of the year, even though there's, you know, six games left or whatever. And the organization is frustrated with, say, they gave a fine or a one-game suspension. Is that enough? I think there still would have been a fight. But
for sure.
What
for
you
a different
were saying,
reason,
Sat, but yeah. what you were saying was right, though. There wouldn't, and to an extent, there wouldn't have been six fights.
Well, it would have been done for a different reason, right? So the way the New York Rangers started that game was not just because of what Tom Wilson did. It was because the owner said they had a lack of toughness that they have, right? So it was more of a team mentality, saying, you know what, we're better than that, we're tougher than that, we can't let our ownership down, the guy who's paying our checks, right? So they had to stand up for themselves in that situation. That's independent of what Tom Wilson, whether he was suspended or not. If he was suspended, then I think the Rangers would have done the exact same thing on the first shift, but it wouldn't have got to a point where, you know, they're chasing Tom Wilson after, and like he left the game. You know, they said it was an upper body injury that might have been just something they wanted to say to get him out of the game, so it didn't
save him for the playoffs, right?
Or just so it didn't get out of hand, right?
I think that's what it was.
But even then, like, people are going after people, and then Pavel Buchnevich, he went and cross checked Mantha in the face again. That's all frustration about what happened the day before or the game before, sorry. Mm-hmm. And those type of things, you can bring the temperature down. The league's responsibility to its players and to its fans and its teams is to bring the temperature down. If they suspended Tom Wilson, like, there's nothing bad that comes out of suspending him. Like, completely. Give him a game. Give him two. Like, what, you know, Matheson did to Elias Pettersson was very similar to what happened with Panarin, except Panarin didn't get a concussion. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Panarin was engaged with Wilson.
Yeah.
But Panarin was engaged with Wilson in this situation, so he had to expect some level of pushback, right? So it's different in that situation, but the end result isn't different just because you're engaged. And we saw the same thing in the Canucks and Oilers game last game when Nurse and McEwen got in the fight, and Nurse grabbed McEwen's leg and took him down. That's also a kind of a dirty little play, right? That can injure a player.
That was very, very risky because he could have slammed his head onto the ice, and that frustrates me more when you consider they suspended McEwen for that little flyby knee. Like, yeah, that's not a hockey play, but neither is what Nurse did. That's a takedown. That's an MMA-style, wrestling-style takedown. That is also not an NHL play. And so for the league, you know, player safety, George Parros, for them to, like, distinguish between those two non-NHL plays and suspend one of them, you know, I don't agree with the direction of player safety right now. And
no,
I'm not sure what can be changed in that regard or what even we're allowed to say or demand to be changed. Because if you do, you're going to get a slap with a fine if the Canucks do or any other organization does. So is that they're like deterring everybody from even speaking out. But like you said, Ryan, people need to speak out more.
Yeah, but the problem is, sorry, just to end this one on my side. The problem is that nobody knows what the standard is, and nobody knows what is going to be suspendable and what is not. There's too much of a gray line. Like, there is no line. It's just gray.
You look at other sports. You're absolutely right. Randeep Janna made a very similar point on his show yesterday on the program, or excuse me, on the People Show, where he said, you know, with that MMA-style takedown from Darnell Nurse on Zach McEwen, now if McEwen smacks his head on the ice and he gets injured, you're absolutely correct that Darnell Nurse is getting some kind of suspension or supplementary discipline. So because McEwen didn't get injured, now it's okay. There's kind of a gray area there, and I can understand why both the fan bases, the players, and everybody involved in the game is really kind of confused as to what's considered a hockey player, what's allowed right now. It's certainly a troubling time and a hard look for the NHL Player Safety Department right now.
It's a rough one, and it removes clarity from the game. But I'll tell you what won't remove clarity from the game: the Kraken play-by-play of our next guest, John Forslund. Stick around. You're so listening to LarshCast on Sportsnet 650 on your home for the Vancouver Canucks.
And now, introducing the starting lineup for the LarshCast: TJ, Ryan, Zach, Joey, and now on Sportsnet 650.
Oh, God, love that call every time. Welcome back to the LarshCast on Sportsnet on this Vancouver Canucks game day against the Edmonton Oilers. I'm Ryan for TJ, Sat, Joey, and producer Joel Gaudet. And in a couple short minutes, we're going to be joined by the new Kraken play-by-play TV broadcaster. And he'll also be calling the Bruins game tonight if you're able to jump on and watch that. John Forslund will be joining us shortly. He is, as with all of our guests, a presentation of HBD Homes. They're a design, build, new home builder with over 20 years of experience specializing in new home construction, laneway homes, and renovations. You can visit their website, hbdhomes.ca. They're Instagram page at HBD_homes, or call them directly 778-968-1491. And guys, I'm really excited about this one, just to get his take on the Kraken and who some of maybe their targets might be in the draft, if he's got any insight. And it's going to be an exciting one. But I'm just wondering, you guys, we got that poll question up right now. Does somebody have an update ready for us? How are we doing over there? What's I'm guessing it's going to be in the 2 to 3 goals.
I think running away with it is actually 4 points for Connor McDavid tonight.
Okay, people are excited.
Yeah, he's got, I think, more than half the vote, or let's see exactly. He has 33.8% of the vote. Okay, so that's running away 4 points. Everybody thinks he's hitting 100 points tonight.
Okay.
Yeah, we got 415 votes on that. Yeah, 34% for the four, and then, you know, 2 and 3 points kind of take even there.
Methinks people want to see some history tonight. It's not about expectations. It's about wanting to see that happen in the game while they're watching. But anyways, without further ado, let's bring on John Forslund, Kraken play-by-play TV broadcaster. Welcome to the show, John. How you doing?
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. How are you?
Oh, we're doing well. Thank you so much for making the time. And I assume you're heavy in preparation mode for the season and for getting yourself prepared. But you've got a game to call tonight against the Boston Bruins. Is that correct as well?
I'm actually in Pittsburgh this afternoon. We have a split regional on NBC. So there's half the country that's going to get the Bruins and the Rangers, and the other half will get Buffalo and Pittsburgh. And then we're scheduled to do one more on Monday night, and then anxiously await the start of the playoffs. So, yeah, so that's what's happening in the now right here.
And do you happen to know, that's super exciting, a nice doubleheader today. Do you happen to know kind of what teams you're going to be calling when the playoffs do start?
No, don't have any clue on that yet. You know, it's a lot of the matchups will determine where we go and whether some of it's done in the studio, which I think in the first round there'll be some of that. And then as we move and progress into the second round, I think we'll be exclusively in the buildings again, which is great. We're in the building here today. And I've had a mixed bag in my schedule this year. Most of the time I'm in the arenas, but we've done a lot of remote broadcasting from the NBC studios in Stamford, Connecticut. So that's an entirely different animal. I hope there's not a lot of that in the playoffs. It's not ideal as a broadcaster, but you have to do the best you can with it.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, especially when the playoffs do begin, you want to feel that electricity in the air and the intensity of the game, and kind of get that to your viewers. So let's move on over to the Seattle Kraken now. Why don't you just fill us in on how that all, you know, got sorted out, and how you became the voice of the Kraken going forward?
Well, 2020 was an interesting year for me. You know, when the league went on pause, I was one of the first people, I think, in the NHL that went through a 14-day quarantine because I was exposed to Rudy Gobert's hotel room. He was in there with his team, the Utah Jazz.
Oh, wow.
He checked out. The Canes came in to play. I did not know I was occupying the room. You never know who had the room before you, right? So I was told as the league went on pause and the Hurricanes were flying home that I was exposed to the virus and needed to self-quarantine at home, and I couldn't get tested because that was a mess at that time. So anyway, that started it. And then in late June, my contract was ready to get addressed by the Hurricanes. And unfortunately, it wasn't addressed in a way that was workable for myself and my family. I thought better of the situation. I thought we were going to be in a better spot. I wasn't. Some of it related, I think, to the pandemic and how my pay would be structured in the next season. So I elected not to renew that contract and not accept their offer. It was difficult. I've been with the Hurricanes since day one, 1997, moved with the team from Hartford. I started with the Whalers in 1991. But as we went through the return to play, I worked for NBC full-time in both bubbles, in Toronto and Edmonton. I was there right to the end in the Stanley Cup Final. And then as we came back home, there were two teams that had openings. One, of course, being the Kraken. The other were the Tampa Bay Lightning. Both teams considered me. Tampa Bay offered me a deal. It wasn't the right fit for me with my national work, so I didn't want to waste a lot of time with that. And I respectfully said no, but it was a great offer. And then in and around the holidays, I had been talking with Todd Lewicki, who's running the Seattle Kraken. And we had some great conversations, and I wasn't sure, you know, anything was going to come. Maybe it would. I was hoping that it would, and it did. And they gave me a great deal. I'm very lucky to get a chance to do this as a broadcaster for the second time in my career, mark their history from day one. I can't wait to get there and to get this thing started. And I know Ron Francis is going to do a remarkable job building that team because I've seen firsthand, you know, what he can do.
Well, that's a pretty amazing. It sounds like it was meant to be for you to end up in Seattle then, and we're sure excited
maybe
to hear you
so.
Start. But
maybe so. Yeah, and they're gonna allow me opportunities to work nationally too, which I hope to do. But that's changed
cool.
Also. The rights have changed in the U.S. So on that side, a lot of it's undetermined. But I know where my home is now. I know it's going to be in Seattle, and with that team, and hopefully we're going to hit the ground running. I know the building's going to be spectacular. The franchise is doing a lot of great things, you know, in and around the community. Most importantly, though, when Ron drafts his team and we see that first group of players hit the ice, everyone's going to compare them to the Vegas Golden Knights, which might be unfair, but I think that's the benchmark. You want to be competitive right away, and that's what the plan is.
Yeah, it's sure going to be interesting to see, and hopefully as we move forward, we can have you on again here to try and play up more of this rivalry that's going to be coming between the Canucks and the Kraken. But I got to go back, and I have to ask because, you know, as a huge sports fan, watching that Rudy Gobert scenario go down and knowing now that you were somebody that was connected to that very event, I've got to ask, when you saw his cavalier attitude towards the COVID disease at the time, after the fact, what sort of range of emotions were going through your head as that was happening? Because I've wondered, you know, how it would affect his teammates and what the response would be, but getting to talk to somebody who actually experienced that, how did that hit you?
Well, I didn't appreciate it, and I didn't appreciate it as a fan watching it the night before. Little did I know any of this was going to go down the next day. Yeah. But I recall this because, you know, I'm a hockey junkie, right? I have to be, and I watch hockey every night of the week. And on that night, there wasn't much. There was a light schedule on that Wednesday before the league paused on the Thursday. And I was in New Jersey. The Hurricanes were to play the Devils on that Thursday, I believe, March 12th. And there was one national game on. It was Chicago and San Jose, and it was a blowout. It wasn't much of a game. So I was flipping around, and I saw all this stuff going on with the Utah Jazz and the game being canceled in Oklahoma City. And then I heard the Rudy Gobert's name, and I don't really follow the NBA much, so I think I've heard of the name, but I wasn't that educated as to who he was and who he played for. But then I saw what happened, and I saw his attitude, you know, fooling around. You got to think before you act, certainly in public, social media, all these things today. I thought it was flippant. I even reached out to our PR guy through text and said, you know, are you watching this? I mean, this guy is kind of, you know, really made a fool of himself earlier in the week. He apologized for it to his credit, and I understand he's a very good guy. But it's a bad moment. That's a bad moment that could happen to any of us. Just kidding around. I'm a big kidder. I might have done the same thing. I don't think so. But, you know, there was some of that attached to this unbelievable catastrophe before the reality sunk in and everybody started to see what we were really talking about. There were a lot of people who were denying this was going on, and I think he was caught up in all of that. So, yeah, that's how I felt, and then I really felt angered by it as I was flying home. They had me isolated on the plane. You know, nobody would go near me because I was exposed to this virus. I had to fly back with the team. That was surreal. So, yeah. Emotions were running in a lot of different ways, and as I got home and started 14 days in isolation.
Brutal.
Well, I mean, little side note: do you remember what the TV show that was binged during the original 14-day quarantine was, if there was any?
Now, there wasn't much, and I'm a very I found out, you know, really how boring I am, you know, when I had to spend all that time with myself. I wouldn't suggest it for anybody. You know, we have a great home in North Carolina of a basement. I was down in our basement. I had all the comforts that anybody needed. But there was too much time to think. There was way too much news on television. That's what I was watching, and that wasn't good for anybody's health. It still isn't today, I don't think. So I was getting caught up in all of that and then wondering, you know, where was this going? And the big thing was, in the state of North Carolina and many places, testing was not available unless you had symptoms. But as we know now, boy, you could have this thing and not have any symptoms. That's how scary it is. So there was a lot of that going on in that room, and I was overjoyed when I was able to return back to the family. And I have two in college, and both were home, and I could hear upstairs a lot of laughing, and they were having a good time. Hopefully they're not poking fun at me, but who knows. But I mean, that's kind of, you're an outsider in your own home, if that makes sense. And that was difficult. It was.
Mm-hmm. It would have to be. I wanted to take a little bit of a step back to when the Hurricanes first moved to Carolina. So the first season that the team was there, do you have any memories of what the public reception was like for the Hurricanes originally coming in, and if you expect it to be even bigger or a little bit less than when you move into Seattle?
Well, the Whalers moved in a 4-month period of time. Okay, so they the announcement was made in March. The official move and where they were going, because there was a couple of places. Columbus was being looked at the time. Nashville, I believe, was being looked at the time. Carolina, obviously. So we didn't know where the Whalers would land. And then in May, it was announced that it would be the Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina area. You know, completely foreign to everybody, and certainly completely foreign to the sport of hockey. They have had some minor pro hockey through the Carolinas over the years, but as a niche game, obviously, with, you know, small fan bases. And it's rich in college basketball tradition, as you know, in college football and NASCAR racing. So, I mean, where will this fit? And when we got there, the Canes had to play out of market in Greensboro, North Carolina, which is 70 minutes to the northwest of Raleigh. So you're out of market. You're in a building that's not going to be your home. You had to wait 2 years for the new building. It was difficult. And then not many people were making the commute, obviously, to come see the Hurricanes play. And not a lot of local people wanted to go because we were kind of just biding our time to get to Raleigh. And so we weren't really embraced, nor did the team embrace the Greensboro market. So it was nowhere close to what you see with expansion teams over the years, and nowhere close to where expansion teams are today. I mean, the buildup for the Seattle Kraken has been tremendous. The waiting list for season tickets is unbelievable. They're going to have a first-class facility that's going to knock everyone's socks off when you see it. And they're going to do everything right, you know, as I said, with their community. And the NHL is going to look at this team, I think, as a model franchise moving forward. A lot of the initiatives they're going to take on. The colors are great. The nickname's cool. You know, there's a lot of things here that are, they're going to make the Kraken, you know, at least – get the curiosity of people and the excitement of kicking off the franchise, and then see how the team competes after that. So I think that market is a pro sports market, obviously, that has tremendous passionate fans that follow the Seahawks, and they did have the NBA there. You've got the Mariners, you've got, you know, you've got you know, a lot of things in place that I think they're going to be able to grab a hold of right away. And make it all come together. So I don't even think it compares at all. I think the Hurricane situation was a move out of haste, a negotiation that broke down with the owner of the team, Peter Karmanis, and the state of Connecticut. And then he said, you know, if I can't get the building that I want, I'm moving this franchise. It's my right to, and he did. And with an expansion team, it's just a totally different scenario.
Absolutely. And we are talking, of course, with John Forsland of the Seattle Kraken play-by-play for the television broadcast. John, I have a question about potential coaching candidates for the expansion team here. And, you know, Travis Green hasn't been re-signed yet here in Vancouver. And there's another name out there, Gerard Gallant, who took the Vegas Golden Knights expansion team to the finals in their first year. What do you think, or which direction do you think Seattle is looking to go? And are those two names, you know, if Green becomes available, but Gallant, is he in the mix? And, you know, where do you think they're going to go?
Well, the only thing, and getting any information, and I know him so well, but any information out of Ron Francis, you might as well try and pry open Fort Knox. It's not going to happen. So, you know, you're just not going to get any information out of him. But he did say at one point, this is going back a few months, that he was hoping to get, you know, an NHL type coach. In other words, with real head coaching experience and the resume and all of that, you know, not a guy with promise, a younger coach, one coming out of minor pro level college hockey or something like that, junior hockey. I think that's what he's looking for. So those two names, they fill the job description or the characteristics and that he's looking for. Gerard did a fantastic job with the Golden Knights and was doing a great job, I thought, with Florida before he was let go there. And that was really a bum's rush the way that went down. Travis Green is an excellent coach. I hope, based on what has happened this season, that he gets an extension. I hope he's allowed to carry it through because, you know, I thought the Canucks would be better this year. I'm surprised they're not. And then you put all the circumstances surrounding the team. I don't know how any, it's a fair evaluation at all on his coaching based on everything he's had to handle. Just getting a team through the pandemic season is enough. Just dealing with the protocols and dealing with a roster that changes every single day, and players are coming in and off taxi squads, and all of this. Every coach has had a difficult circumstance along with the players. So anyway, that's my take on him. I hope he stays there. There's another name that's been rumored because of the connection with Carolina. That would be Rod Brind'Amour. He's another coach, unless you know, he has signed today. But as of this morning, I don't believe he was signed with his team. If he's available, I think a lot of teams will look long and hard at Rod because he's done a fantastic job in three seasons as a head coach at this level. So there'll be others too. And, you know, and if I know Ron, he's got something up his sleeve. And maybe there's something else that it's just going to surprise all of us. But it'll be a calculated decision. It'll be an important one. And it's going to have to be someone that's really going to share, you know, Ron's vision and have a great working relationship with Ron. Because I think in his first go around as a general manager with the Hurricanes, he learned a lot. He learned a lot about himself. He learned about the job. He learned, you know, how he would do it if he got a second opportunity. And he has.
All right, John. And I know you have a lot of preparation to do for your game tonight, so we'll let you go in just a moment. But, you know, we do look forward to speaking to you again as the, you know, the year goes on before the Kraken hit the ice for the first time. And we want to make sure that you can get in some good rivalry topics between the Canucks and the Kraken going forward. So welcome to the fold in the Pacific Northwest, and we look forward to speaking to you again.
Look forward to it, and look forward to getting to Vancouver again, one of my favorite places. And let's get back to normal, right, guys, as soon as possible. But thanks for having
me.
I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure talking to you.
All right, that was John Forsland, the future play-by-play broadcaster for the Seattle Kraken. And, you know, we'll have a lot of topics to discuss with John here coming up, you know, in the next few months. And as a Kraken,
Phenomenal.
Fantastic interview.
We'll have another similar type of interview later on with Joey Kenward. I think there's a lot of similarities between the two, but no, definitely a lot of good insights there from John. So,
You know, I want to address something he said about Green, because last week I was kind of going hard on Green, or just the coaching changes. Like I'm looking for some kind of fresh voice to come into this coaching staff, and I did kind of single out Green. I want to acknowledge that he didn't really have a lot of practice time with his team this year. You know, with their brutal start to the year and down the stretch, as John alluded to, and as we all know, with the pandemic situation as it unfolded. But, you know, the first real batch of practice time came during the Canucks bye week, and then they got hit by COVID. So the timing was really brutal. And, you know, the team had seemingly turned a corner and was finding their footing. You know, Demko was playing lights out hockey, you know, before the bye week. And so I still believe fresh voices are needed on the bench, but that doesn't necessarily have to be at the behest of Green himself. So I'll just add that, because John kind of made a couple of great points. And I was thinking about saying that before he even mentioned all that, because it's not fair to just criticize Green alone and given the situation that this entire team went through this year. So I'll just add that little asterisk to my little coaching
fair enough
debate.
I mean, we'll see what happens, right? Like, and I want to get into this with Joey coming up in the 11 o'clock hour is you know, the Canucks' playoff dreams are done. I mean, the one.
Well, hold your horses. Like, Montreal loses. No, Montreal loses their next three games.
Okay, fine. Whatever. Say what you want. The Canucks are not making the playoffs, right? So, how does Travis Green actually finish off the season? And what's his strategy going to be? Does he have the motivation to play the kids and trying to build for next season? Because he doesn't have that contract for next season. So, what type of motivation does Travis Green have to go into these games and coach them? I mean, he's always going to try to win, because that's just how people, you know, coaches and players are wired. But it's going to be interesting to see what happens over the course of the next, you know, couple of weeks. So I really want to get into that with Joey. But we do have a little switch coming up next segment. I know we're going to get into some football talk with Stacey Joe Ross, right? So I know, Ryan, you're going to be taking that interview.
Yeah, it's gonna be awesome. There's been quite a few developments here. Obviously, we got the Aaron Rodgers situation and a few other things, but also get some updates on what I would consider a very successful draft from the Seahawks as well, and maybe see what's kicking around with TJ Saints as well too. Whether the odds of seeing Rodgers in the black and gold might happen at some point as well too. You never know, folks. But stick around. We are the LarshCast on Sportsnet 650 on this Canucks day, game day, and we've got Stacey Joe Ross coming up shortly. Stick around.
This is Sportsnet Today with the LarshCast. Now here are your boys on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Welcome back to the show. We are your boys from the LarshCast, taking you right up until the 12 o'clock hour here. We just heard and had a spectacular interview with John Forslund, the new play-by-play announcer for the Kraken, and we're about to have a quick conversation as well with his Seattle counterpart on the football side, and who will also be covering the Kraken. We've got Stacey Joe Ross, a frequent guest and contributor to the LarshCast, coming up in a couple minutes as well here too. She's from ESPN 710, and as always, a presentation of HBD Homes. And it's
hold on, Ryan. Hit me. Joel, are you there? What kind of a... So I send Joel songs to come out of break, right? And I picked Only You, you know, from 112. I don't know what kind of remix that was right
there. That was very sensual.
I had no idea. I hadn't heard the original myself, so I didn't know that was a remix. I just
you don't know the
come
original?
On, Joel's the biggest 112 fan. It was a video off of their official YouTube, so... I'm not sure if I got the wrong one there, but we'll set the mood, perhaps. We'll say
that was very sensual.
What kind of mood are you trying to set here? Oh, my God.
Wish I could quit you, Ryan.
That was something, man. I mixed
with Ryan's voice. Oh, extra
sweet. Oh, yeah.
I was about to do like the my darling.
Get
super deep on that thing, but... No,
we're going off the rails, boys. We're going off the rails.
Yeah. Focus.
Off the rails on the Swayze Express.
Exactly. Oh, nobody puts baby in the corner. But I think maybe it's like Kevin Bacon. I'm bad at this.
Yeah. Roadhouse.
All right. Back on track.
Anyways. Yeah, we're going to talk to Stacey about some football here shortly as well. And it's been a heck of an interesting week on the end. I mean, it's been an interesting week on the NHL side as well, too, for various reasons that we'll get into with Joey Kenward shortly as well. But, you know, a lot of news coming out. Obviously, we had the draft in the NFL and a couple teams making some pretty interesting choices here. I don't know, TJ, before Stacey joins us, how did you feel about your Saints' performance in the draft? Any thoughts?
Well, you know, the Saints kind of didn't really have a plan, in my opinion, of what they were, because I still don't know what they're planning to do. Who's going to be the quarterback?
Right.
You know, so I'm kind of confused. I think a lot of Saints fans are confused. And I'll ask Stacey her opinion. She's here right now. Welcome to the show, Stacey.
Hi, guys.
Welcome.
Glad to have you again this Saturday morning. Yeah, we're just talking about the Saints draft picks. And Stacey, what was your thought on, or what is your thought on the state of the New Orleans Saints?
Here's the thing with the Saints. They've obviously been heading up that kind of like regular group of contenders in the NFC, and it feels weird to not automatically include them there. They don't have Drew Brees. The number one thing you need to be, you know, considered a favorite most of the time, the vast majority of the time, is going to be a franchise quarterback. I don't think Jameis Winston nor Taysom Hill can be that guy for them. That said, they still have an insane amount of talent. Still have a ton of talent on defense. They have Kamara. They have Thomas. And so they also have like one of the best and most successful head coaches in the NFL. And so it feels tough to really kind of be down on them. And I don't know if a mix of that is habit, or if that's because the talent they still have, but I'm not as high as I was when they had Brees. Obviously, I don't think they're going to be down for very long.
What did you think about their draft this year? Because obviously they kind of, the first three picks were defensive oriented. So I think their kind of strategy is to just bolster the defense, knowing that they've lost their best offensive weapon, their quarterback, Drew Brees, right? So what did you think about their draft?
Yeah, I think that's certainly the way to go. Their defense has been kind of up and down. At times it's been a strength of the team, and other times it's kind of fallen apart. I really haven't like minded it of late. I think that at times it's really been a strength for them that's been a little overshadowed by the offense. So I think, too, you look around their division, it's the wise thing to do, not just in the NFL, the direction offenses are moving, but you think about the teams that they're going to be facing regularly, whether it's Tampa Bay, whether it's Atlanta, that just picked up Kyle Pitts and could be on the move with some more offensive weapons there. So you got to compete. You got to get out of your division, right, before you can really make a push to a Super Bowl. So if you look around their division, you're going to need to shore up your defense.
Yeah, it's such a great point, and just a wonderful segue. You always seem to tee us up so nicely for our next questions because you
she
cover
knows
something.
I do what I can.
Like you, I don't know if you just, yeah, you just know how we operate here, but you mentioned not being able to win without that number one quarterback. I got to ask, with a healthy Dak Prescott, assuming he comes back in at 100%, do you think that the Dallas Cowboys are the front runner to come out of the NFC East this next season, or where would you place them if he is healthy?
Yes. I do. I think that their defense was atrocious, which, like, that's not a secret to anyone. Fact. And I was really worried that Jerry Jones, maybe it was just after that video he had talking about Kyle Pitts where he misused some kind of idiom. I can't even remember what it was. But I was worried that Jerry Jones would go for the shiny new toy, not address the defense at all, and that team would just look to bring on more weapons on offense, which, like, yeah, they could use them. Like, Zeke Elliott hasn't been the Zeke Elliott we've seen before. Like, Dak Prescott is coming back from a season-ending injury, and I don't think a career-altering one, but like, it was a very devastating injury. However, they needed to fix the defense. Like, that was what they should have used with their first pick, certainly with the bulk of their draft capital. Ended up addressing that. Thankfully for them, it was the right move. I think if you're a Seahawks fan, you're watching, probably happy that they also took a linebacker at one point, thinking that eliminates potentially any kind of connection to KJ Wright. I think it was the right move. And you know what? To be completely honest, even if they wouldn't have, say that they would have traded up or taken Kyle Pitts, which I think would have been a mistake, I still would have had them as the favorite in that division, which was such a train wreck last year. And I don't think any team got substantially better because they still have the best quarterback.
What did you think of the Eagles picking up Kerryon Johnson? I mean, how does that back end look for you in Philadelphia now?
Next to Miles Sanders as well. I don't know that blows my socks off. I think it's just something that they really needed. I don't know that he's going to be like, we're talking running back Kerryon Johnson, right? I don't know that he's going to be like a franchise altering guy. I think, you're under a new coach with, they have Nick Sirianni, a new head coach there, figuring out your quarterback situation. It still feels like they're hesitant to even commit to Jalen Hurts, and it's the weirdest situation. I don't quite understand it. I think that they are a team that still has a lot to prove. And as an aside, there was a fantastic piece in The Athletic that I can't recommend enough by Shiel Kapadia, who used to be a Seahawks reporter. He's a fantastic person, returned to cover the Eagles after having started his career there. And he has an article just about that fall from grace that Philadelphia had, because it was not long ago when they were in the Super Bowl. You know what I mean? Like, it was not long ago when they played, first of all, one of the most fun Super Bowls I can remember watching, but also were kind of one of the powerhouses in the NFC, and then just completely fell off and completely stumbled from the top, in part because of the failures, really, of Carson Wentz. But there was a lot of kind of weird stuff going on with the head coach GM situation. That seems to maybe have ironed itself out with the hiring of Nick Sirianni. We'll see. But that team has a lot to prove before they're in that conversation competing with the rest of the NFC.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there, and it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. I want to shift the conversation to the Seahawks here now, Stacey, for obvious reasons.
Didn't see that coming.
Yeah, I know, huge surprise, right? I know. I'm a Seahawks fan. I get it. I believe it or
well,
not.
Well, not
I think
just
Stacey is too.
She's exactly.
Okay, so I got to ask Stacey. In my estimation, and shout out to my boy George in Burnaby for helping me with this one, because he is an absolute draft analyst superstar. But Seahawks having only three picks in this draft were kind of up against it. But I feel like they kind of nailed it. They got Eskridge, who's a speed demon, and I think he's going to be a great addition to the DK and Lockett combo. They got Trey Brown, who's a potential stud corner, even though he's a bit small. And then they've got Stone Forsey, who's a 6'8" monster tackle. Would you say that Carroll absolutely nailed this draft? And what's your take on either of those three players?
I like all three picks. I think that Forsyth was a bit of a steal. He was projected to go as early as the second round. That would have been a stretch. I think that his average grade, if you were to look around the kind of the average that scouts had, was about a third or fourth round grade. That said, going in the sixth round, that would then be a steal. He got knocks on his run blocking. They didn't do a ton of it in Florida. Florida led college football, I think, in passing yards per game. They didn't need to run the ball, and they didn't very often. So,
yeah,
it was hard for him to kind of back that up. So I'm curious to see how he's going to be with you know, Pete Carroll's offense. He won't be. I would be shocked if he was starting this year. He'll be competing with a guy like Cedric Ablehi for that swing tackle spot. I loved the pick of Dwayne Eskridge. And we talked to his head coach, his coach was Tim Lester, was so high on this kid. Like, the way that he talked about him, he kept saying how special he was, how impressed he always was by Dwayne Eskridge. And it really, what you can tell when you talk with coaches, when you talk with teammates, whether or not they really like a guy. Like, you can just kind of get the vibe. I'm sure you guys have experienced it a million times. You're talking to a coach, you ask him about one player, he won't shut up about him. You ask him about another, and he's like, yeah, he's good kid. He's turned a lot around, and you're like, you hate this kid. So with Dwayne, it was, I think, a relief to hear him just think that, like, this kid is an NFL player. There were moments that he gave us where he realized that. Like, there was a moment he talked about Dwayne Eskridge coming back from his broken collarbone and just running I don't even think it was like a complicated route or anything. It was just, he talked about how much he had evolved as a wide receiver, having spent time at corner, and then getting healthier coming back, and was like, I knew that he could be an NFL player when I saw that moment. And that moment must have stood out to him, if he can recall it when unprompted, when we just kind of threw it his way during an interview. So really excited about him. And I think Seahawks fans should be. Very long-winded answer, but that is to say that I do think that they, considering they had three picks, a couple holes to fill, I think they did a pretty good job. They're going to eventually find out whether they missed on a couple guys. Creed Humphrey, who was a really highly rated interior lineman, was still on the board when they made the pick of, I think Eskridge. I think he went a couple picks later. That's going to be one of those picks people probably look to, especially people that would have preferred that they get an offensive lineman over a wide receiver. That's going to be one of those picks people look to if Creed Humphrey goes on and becomes an All-Pro or a Pro Bowler. And say, oh, you could have had him. That happens every single draft. I really do not mind at all that they address wide receiver. I think it was the most controversial pick for this team. But again, guys, going back to that conversation we were having about how the league is evolving, how offenses are evolving, if you want to get to a Super Bowl in today's NFL, you've got to be elite on one side of the ball. Ideally, you've got to be elite on offense and able to hang on defense. It's rare you can be great on defense and great on offense the way Tampa Bay was.
Yeah.
You've got to be elite somewhere. And adding another wide receiver to that group helps you get there. I am all for it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I would say that, you know, with only three picks, Seahawks fans have reason to be excited. And Eskridge is going to be an absolute beauty.
I want to challenge Stacey on that, though. You said ideally offense. Wouldn't you look at the recent history and suggest defense is actually what's more important, even with the Buccaneers, you know, and going back to the Broncos and the Seahawks and what the Patriots did against the Rams, you know, like, wouldn't you suggest defense is actually more important?
I think that's a very, it's a completely fair argument to make. And like, you could successfully make that argument. For me personally, I find that the greatest commonalities among the teams in recent seasons that get to the conference championships are top tier offenses. So all those teams, I'm pretty sure, had a top 10 offensive line. A lot of those teams were near the top of the league in scoring. I think the Chiefs, I know the Saints were up there, Tampa Bay obviously up there, all hovering around 30 points per game, with Green Bay at 32 points per game around there. I think that when you look at ultimately what made the difference between those four conference championship teams, you're completely right. The best defensive line won. Tampa Bay, far and away the best defense of those four remaining teams. That said, I think that Seattle has invested so much draft capital, I'm getting anecdotal now, has invested so much draft capital on the defensive side of the ball that it's like, make it work. You traded a pair of first-round picks for a safety. Like, your defense better be elite. Like, you're paying $18 million to Bobby Wagner. You better be elite. And and so I think that, yes, I think that there are many people I work with that would say, completely agree with you, 100%. The most important thing you can invest in the trenches is on the defensive line, and that makes the difference. I think you've got to get there, though. You've got to get to the championship game. You've got to get to the divisional round.
And that's fair, too.
The teams that far and away get there are ones that are near the top of the league on offense.
And not only that, we've talked about it before on the show previously. If you've got a healthy offense that's able to create long drives and sustain drives, you're keeping your defense off the field for long portions of time and keeping them fresh as well, too. So, I mean, there is a
one
kind of helps the other, too, where, I mean, I guess if you've got a good defense and they're forcing turnovers, it gives your offense more of a chance to run or get the ball as well, too. But offense really, to me, I would agree, Stacey, is kind of the driver here. And
if you're going to get there on defense, you need to be elite on defense. Like, you need to be one of the best, and you can't also be bad on offense. Like, the Rams were an elite defense, not a good offense at all. And it took them further than Seattle, but didn't take them all the way. So when you look at some of the teams that you can say defense won that championship, think of how good those defenses were, right? Denver, Seattle, Tampa Bay, in there too.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. And once again, you've teed me up perfectly to my next question, because I want to talk about Russell Wilson's mindset going into the season here and whether or not they've done enough around him. And specifically, not only the draft, but the Seahawks picked up two undrafted pieces of free agent contracts. They got Tamorian Terry as a receiver who somehow went undrafted. The Hawks were able to scoop him up. And then they've also got Brian Mills, who's a shutdown corner. Do you think with the draft and with these two unsigned pieces, this is enough of what Wilson was looking for? I mean, you talked about, you know, them focusing on defense and trading away draft picks, but on the offensive side of the ball, have they done enough to give Russell Wilson the tools and the defense that he's going to need next season to feel confident?
Okay, so I'm going to like peel back the curtain and be totally honest with you guys. My co-host is Russell Wilson's private quarterback coach. He's a friend of Russell Wilson. And so even though he, like, when he is on our show and we're talking about stuff, he's reacting to what he thinks and saying what he thinks. I will still press him to be like, I'll still throw questions where I'll be like, I mean, do you think the Seahawks did enough on the offensive line, Jake? Like, leaning in, kind of eyeing him, like, do you think that? And then, of course, I'll, like, read into everything he says, because I'm a horrible friend and also obsessed with trying to piece apart little bits of rumor, because we all work in the news and in broadcasting. So I will say, I think that Jake feels like, well, they always could have done more. Like, there were he thinks that they should have gotten a center. I think that that's Jake thinking they should have gotten a center. But it is hard not to think, if you're Russell Wilson, you're looking at this offensive line and you're like, ooh, love Gabe Jackson. That was a great addition. Thank you, John Schneider, for using one of four draft picks on that. However, you've still got this center here that, like, you weren't really high on, didn't stand out last year. You gave him a team-friendly deal, and you're having him compete with a guy that was, like, on the practice squad. And I just feel like, you know, I don't know that Russell Wilson, if I'm in his mind and I have to guess what he thinks, I don't know that he thinks they did enough. Mm-hmm. But
I would agree.
I think he's also realistic, right? He's a pragmatic person. And he also has to recognize that I didn't get a center. Instead, four picks ahead of that or five picks ahead of that, they took this wide receiver. Maybe he ends up being Tyreek Hill. Like, maybe he ends up being this really speedy guy that we need, you know, on offense and haven't really, frankly, had for a while. Like, it's you get a pick and choose. You got three picks. You don't get everything. You get, you know,
at the same time,
one or two things.
But at the same time, like, he's still one of the most sacked quarterbacks throughout his career, you know, and
yeah,
if you're Russell Wilson, yeah. I mean, how many talented wide receivers have come into the mix? It doesn't matter. You gotta have time to throw them the ball.
Right.
And I just think it might be one of the biggest failures of an organization if the Russell Wilson tenure ends up in just that one Super Bowl run off the heels of that fantastic legendary or Legion of Boom, you know, that defense. They're gonna waste his talent. He's gonna get older. His legs are not gonna stay as you know, quick and mobile. But yeah, it's just, I can understand his frustration and the frustration of Seahawks fans. You know, if Nav was here, he'd be loving it, but he's not. So let's shift it to, I want to ask you, Stacey, and by the way, we are talking with Stacey Joe Ross of 710 ESPN Seattle here on Sportsnet 650. Which teams, in your opinion, you know, league-wide, let's say, have taken a significant step forward in your mind this offseason?
Oh, it's hard not to go automatically to the Bears, guys, right? I mean, you look at the Bears, you look at them getting Justin Fields when I would bet that they absolutely never thought they would. No one saw Justin Fields being potentially available there. And not only that, the Bears were at 20 overall. The Bears fans were not thinking, what quarterback are we taking at 20? They were thinking, like, what's going to be available? Can we please get Russell Wilson? And then the Seahawks not trading Russell Wilson to Chicago may have had this kind of domino effect of them potentially finding their franchise guy of the future. They have a couple other weapons they've got in there. I am curious to see them. They've got some more steps forward to take. Like, the piece they added I'm most excited about is obviously Justin Fields. It's not like they went and added, you know, a top tier wide receiver, and they do have him, though. They franchise tagged him, but and added all these other guys. It's just that no one foresaw them being able to get Justin Fields, and it is hard not to say that they've taken a big step forward because it's the most important piece you can have. I like the pieces Atlanta added. I think Atlanta had a really great draft. I think Kyle Pitts is one of the most pro-ready guys that were in this class, and maybe everyone's wrong about him, but I don't think we will be. I think he's going to be a really fun player to watch for a long time. And now they continue to add to a pretty stacked, stacked offense. Makes it a bit easier for an aging Matt Ryan. So I think Atlanta is in there. The NFC South as a whole could be tough. It's got to be one of the tougher divisions. All of the NFC West took their steps forward outside of the draft, which is interesting, but makes the division that much tougher, right? Like, you look ahead of April and you see Arizona adding J.J. Watt, San Francisco getting healthier, the L.A. Rams, you know, extending a lot of their guys and keeping a lot of their guys and upgrading at quarterback. I mean, make no mistake, you didn't see a lot of moves outside of Trey Lance in this draft for the NFC West. All of these teams have gotten better.
There's no way you did it again. Are you kidding me? You mentioned Trey Lance right now, and that is exactly where I wanted to go with the rest of this conversation.
It's like we are all one mind, you guys. We've been doing this for long enough. We're in simpatico.
Again, like, you should have seen the look on my face when you just brought up Trey Lance. Like, we are just in sync today. But I've got to ask, You know, we've heard, you know, the 49ers staff talk about, you know, the potential of what's going to happen there. To me, it looks like they've created a potential for a two-headed monster here between Garoppolo and Trey Lance. Do you think that there's going to be a healthy competition and they're going to look to trade Garoppolo? Is Lance the guy? Are they going to sit him for a year? What's the mindset behind what they're doing there?
So, John Lynch...
Or is there one?
...very recently. I would guess that there certainly is. John Lynch just did an interview where he was like, we would be fine with Trey Lance sitting on the bench throughout the course of the remainder of Jimmy G's contract if Jimmy G's playing like a Super Bowl caliber quarterback. In theory, they're probably right. You're paying Jimmy Garoppolo, though, $24 million-ish per year, which isn't like record, right? We've seen Patrick Mahomes' money at this point. We've seen Russell Wilson and Aaron Rodgers' money, like $24 million per year. Like, congrats. You're like getting close to a defensive end deal there. Like, it's not.
Yeah, no kidding.
Not your quarterback money anymore. But it is a pretty penny if you are not looking to have him be your guy. Now, I could see certainly Jake thinks that Trey Lance will be their week one starter. He is dead set on it. He's like, Jimmy G, I don't know if he's on the bench. I don't know if he's out of here. Trey Lance is on the field week one. I don't see that, not because Trey Lance can't be that guy for them. He has essentially one season of experience. I don't need to tell you guys or your listeners this. We all know it. He was one of the most profiled guys heading into the draft. Incredibly high upside, essentially one season. And one season at North Dakota State, right? Like, he's not playing SEC teams. No offense to North Dakota State. No offense to the
FCS. No, it's an excellent point, though. You're absolutely right.
You know, so I think it was a perfect season against less than stellar competition. So what do you make of it? Like, what do you take from that? So I think that it is in their best interest to hang on to Jimmy G. I think they will hang on to Jimmy G. I don't know that I see Jimmy G being here throughout the course of the next 2 years because $24 million can get you a lot of other players.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of being in sync, Stacey, bop, bop, bye. It's time to go. Sorry, guys. Sorry, everyone. That was so bad. As it was coming out of my mouth, I felt so shame. But
immediate regret.
We are all out of time, Stacey, so we'll talk to you again next week. Thank you for joining us again here on the LarshCast on a game day broadcast of the Canucks versus the Oilers. You are listening to Sportsnet 650, home of the Vancouver Canucks.
Yeah, baby. Yeah. Woo! Back again.
That's right.
Luda.
Feel this.
This gets meaner and meaner each time, baby.
It's time for Sportsnet Today. This is the LarshCast on your home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Welcome back to the LarshCast here on Saturday morning on a game day broadcast. Canucks playing the Oilers later tonight. Connor McDavid, 100-point watch. Will he get it in four or in tonight in 4 points he needs, or will he get it in the next four games? I mean,
no.
He's obviously going to get it, but when will he get it?
I think the real question is, can the Canucks score four goals on their first four shots again?
There it is.
So we're gonna talk to Joey Kenward here in just a moment. But before we get to Kenward, did you guys catch the clip? I mean, it was live on Tuesday on Donnie and Dolly, but they also posted a clip, Rick Dollywell and the whole Red Shoe Diaries.
That was
one of the funniest clips I've ever seen. And I'm calling him Red Shoe Rick from now on because that was so good. And, you know, Red Shoe Diaries, I mean, I'm not going to get into it either, but David Duchovny from the X-Files was on that. And guess who else was on that show? A little tidbit. Joey from Friends, Matt LeBlanc, two episodes. No. That was hilarious.
Really?
Yeah. The more you know. But anyways, before we get to Kenward, I want to talk a little bit about playoff expectations. And I hinted at this with a tweet I sent out. And it's just basically, I just want to highlight a few things. This is not about the GM. This is just about playoff expectations. And we'll get to Joey in just 1 second here. But on the whole playoffs, you know, two playoffs in 7 years the Canucks have had recently. It's easy to say that, but it's harder to accept the truth of it being two different cores, all right? And once this team turns a corner, it's 2-7. It's easily going to become 7-7. Look at the Colorado Avalanche. They made the playoffs three times in 11 years before this recent string of 3 years. The Carolina Hurricanes missed the playoffs for 9 straight seasons before turning the corner. You know, Dallas made it twice in 10 seasons before the last few years, and they might even miss it again this year. The Islanders hadn't made it out of the first round in 21 seasons, and they missed 9 of their last 13. The Panthers had 3 in 19. The Leafs, we already know their history, once in 11 years before 2016 and 17. Go down the list, even the Tampa Bay Lightning, the current Cup champs, made the playoffs one time in 6 years before their current core turned a corner. So all I want to say here, and I want to ask Joey his thoughts on this too, but I just think people in general, you know, Canucks fans especially, just need to be a bit more patient and realize this isn't something that happens overnight.
Just a couple more years.
And that our internal burning desire for a Stanley Cup shouldn't irrationalize what is a very, very difficult path to ultimate glory. Joey, with that, I mean, Sat, you want to say something, but let's bring Joey on first. Welcome to the show, Joey. How are you doing?
I'm well, guys. How are you today?
Not too bad. And I see you're coming for that number one spot again. Hey, draft music special there, but...
Not necessarily. You guys take things out of context sometimes, but that's okay. Carry on.
Whoa.
So let explain it. Explain it then, Joey.
Clearly don't have all the information.
Yeah, that's it. You can take that song for whatever it's worth. It's about as good an intro as you could have right now. When you've got classic rap artists like Ludacris and paying homage to Austin Powers, you guys can take it all different ways if you want. So.
It's a dream team.
All right.
Well, let's get into this now. But the biggest story I think going into the Canucks game tonight has to be Connor McDavid and his. You know, pursuance of 100 points in 53, 54 games, whatever it's going to be. Do you think, Joey, off the top, do you think Connor McDavid is going to get his 4 points tonight?
I don't think so. Do I think he's going to get 100 points? Yes. I don't know if he's going to put up 4 tonight against Vancouver. Now, he could, and he already has within the last 7 days. I don't know if it's going to happen tonight. You know, I'm looking up and down the rosters here. On the game notes package, and you see Connor McDavid with 96 points. The next closest player to him is Leon Draisaitl. He's nearly 20 points ahead of him. And they played almost the same number of games. So they have played the same number of games. Like I've said this many times, and I'll continue to say it, and not to sound like Captain Obvious, but our league right now has a boatload of superstars. I mean, you look on both sides of the border in all divisions, in all conferences. There's fantastic superstar talent in the NHL. I mean, rattle them off. Nathan MacKinnon, you know, just all of these great star players. And you know what? And this is no disrespect to any of them, but none of them hold a candle to Connor McDavid. None of them.
The Nathan MacKinnon thing is funny because I heard a stat.
Don't get me wrong about
Nathan. No, but Joey, listen to this stat. I just read this tweet. I forgot. I want to give the person credit, but I forgot the name. If you take away McDavid's 31 goals, he still has more points than Nathan MacKinnon this year.
Yeah, but I mean, that's just kind of a weird. I mean, weird how can stat. You even use that as a comparison?
Well, I'm just saying it's ridiculous. Like,
McDavid his stats are eyeballs.
Tears above, you know?
But what I'm saying is, isn't it nice to have a team last year when Connor McDavid was the best player in the league, bar none, and his teammate was named the MVP of the NHL. Like, that's the class of player we're talking about in Connor McDavid. He's as good as it gets right now in professional sports, anywhere, as far as a leader of a team. And, Canucks have to do it. Are going to try, again, weird phrase, you got to try to contain them. You can't stop them, but you got to try to do your best to contain them. And even in a losing cause on home ice the other night, he still was a pretty effective player for the home team.
Yeah, and I mean the thing that gets me is he's doing this, and he doesn't even look like he's playing a good game. It's just natural. The NHL just seems too easy for Connor McDavid, and I just don't know how the Canucks can hope to contain, or leave the Canucks, how any team can hope to contain Connor McDavid. They just kind of have to let him get his points.
Yeah, and you look at his stats alone against Vancouver this year, 8 games, 17 points.
Good
Lord. Oh, man. That's averaging 2 points a game. Like, I mean, he's as good as it gets. He's a treat to watch. And I guess the Canucks can only keep their fingers crossed that they're not part of history should it get made, when it gets made, when he hits the century mark here in 2021.
Yeah, we know that Vancouver has a history, as we've extolled earlier in the show, of kind of allowing that stuff to happen on Canucks ice. But I got to ask, we were debating about this a little bit earlier, and once again, we're talking to Joey Kenward of Kenward's Corner on Sportsnet 650 on your Canucks game day broadcast here. Where would you, and I realize this is a tough question to ask, and if you don't necessarily have an exact answer for it, I understand, but where would you rank Connor McDavid's season, given that he's going to essentially hit 100 points in a shortened season? Where would you rank him in terms of some of the greatest offensive performances of all time in say the Gretzky era, and how do you make that conversion between eras, or can you?
It's tough to make comparisons because the game is played at such a different pace, and the rules and the way the game is managed is so different than when Gretzky played in the 80s or when Mario played in the 90s. And, you know, you compare, in my opinion, definitely put him in the top five, maybe top three, as far as single season accomplishments when you're talking about all that's at stake. And remember, I mean, they're playing without fans, and don't kid yourself, that makes a big difference to those on the ice when you're feeding off the energy, whether it's positive or negative energy in a building. Some players thrive off of that. So a completely different season on so many different levels. But yeah, when you talk about Gretzky's campaigns, part of those Oilers dynasties, I think the last time any player was close to 100 points, and I think Raja mentioned it in the sports update, you've got to go back to when, 96, when Mario did it with the Penguins. I mean, this is the conversation. These are the players, the Hall of Fame talent that Connor McDavid is in the same conversation with when we're talking about single best seasons of all time. And the Canucks have certainly had a front row seat to it on many nights, and they're going to have another front row seat to it again this evening in Northern Alberta.
So, Joey, speaking of the Canucks and, you know, their situation going forward, you know, unlikely to make the playoffs, but potentially in the mix for a top 10 draft pick again this year, what's your sense on how teams feel about the draft coming up? And with, you know, not being able to scout players as much as you normally would under normal circumstances, like, what's your sense when it comes to how teams are viewing this draft and whether – beyond the first pick, let's say, you know, two to ten, like, how much movement what do you anticipate happening there? Like, what's the sense?
Well, it's certainly, we talk about it all the time, don't we? A season unlike any other for those on the ice. It's a season unlike any other for those off the ice that are helping build a franchise for the future. You know, it's been very, very on only a handful of occasions, and the majority of them would have been in the United States. Up until the last few months, of course, when CHL and Tier 2 hockey resumed, that the majority of the scouting was taking place for scouts watching games on their laptops, not getting that eagle eye view from, you know, the stands or the press box to watch the future stars of the NHL. It's tough to say. I think that many teams might have the opinion of, well, if you're not going to make the playoffs, then you better keep your fingers crossed that you're going to get a high pick. But having said that, you know, every team, whether they're going to be in the draft lottery or they're going to be picking late in each round, they've all watched the same players the same amount of time. And they've all been restricted to scouting way differently than they ever have before. Does that mean there's not going to be fantastic talent available for each team? No, not at all. There's going to be great players taken in this upcoming draft. But it's going to be really, really hard to... I think, in my opinion, evaluate and you know, determine what a player's long-term future is based on limited viewing and based on how you've had that limited viewing. It's a very important draft. All drafts are. But I get the sense that for the first time in a long time, whether you're in the top 10 or in the draft lottery at all, the majority of teams are going to be in the same boat here. When it comes to the draft class of 2021.
Joey, switching topics over to the Canucks on-ice product at the moment. We saw Cole Lind and Jack Rathbone make their NHL debuts this past week. Both seem to fit in. Rathbone got his first goal in the last game against the Oilers there. What do you, how do you think that those two fit in, and what does it mean for the other young guys trying to crack the lineup for the Canucks at this point in the season?
Well, let's start with Rathbone first. We've seen him in two games. I don't think looked out of place at all. Consider the fact that he's going against a pretty high-octane opponent in Edmonton. He's looked okay. I include that first game when, you know, he saw McDavid and Draisaitl on multiple occasions coming against him on odd man rushes. I thought he looked much more comfortable, and that goes without saying when you play your second game. When you get that first goal in professional hockey at the highest level, that's just going to give you an extra shot of adrenaline, and certainly that was the case with Rathbone the other night in the 6-3 win in Edmonton. I think he's got a very bright future. You know what impressed me? The fact was he was the most physical defenseman on the lineup that night for Vancouver, led all blue liners in hits with three. So I don't mind his play, albeit on a short sample size. In the case of Cole Lind, really liked his debut. I mean, going into an environment like Toronto to take on a team, like the Leafs, like that's a tall order to have that, and didn't mind him. And then I thought the last couple of games, it's a little dose of reality right now. Clocked in just over 10 minutes, as an example, the other night in a game that was in complete control. So certainly, fans, keep your eyes on these younger players. They're going to be given more opportunities to play. And another younger player, I'm not sure if you mentioned it, but Mark Michaelis, he's back into the lineup tonight. So I think if anybody was expecting Louis Erickson to maybe come in for the suspended Zach MacEwen, that's probably not going to happen. And then one other young player to keep an eye on here in the days ahead will be Jonah Gadjevich. He's in Winnipeg waiting for the team. They're going to head to Manitoba after tonight's game, and I would suspect that when Vancouver starts their road swing in Winnipeg, that we're going to see Gadjevich make his NHL debut. So certainly a lot of fans have been clamoring to see the young future players of this organization, and they're going to get a chance here through the month of May.
All right, we're talking with Joey Kenward here on the Larsh Cast on Sportsnet 650. And Joey, kind of sticking with that theme of playing the young kids, you know, Travis Green, we've talked a lot about him and his lack of an extension going to next season. And with the playoff picture all but, you know, finalized and the Canucks not going, you know, further into the spring and summer playing in the playoffs, how do you think Travis is going to approach these last few games and the last couple of weeks? And is he going to try to set up for the next season knowing, well, that, you know, he doesn't have a contract going to the next season? Or what's the focus going to be, you think?
You know, I said this with you guys a week ago, and I'll continue to say it, and he, like any other coach in the league, they're going to prepare to win. They're going to prepare to win, and he's going to feel that on that given night, whoever the opponent is, he's going to fill out his lineup card with the players at his disposal that he thinks is going to give his team the best opportunity to get 2 points. Now, does that mean he's not going to play the kids? No. I think you're going to see a lot of new faces. You just look at, and we know of the injury situation for this team, and I know that's something a lot of people don't want to talk about. Many want to ignore it. They've got so many guys out, sidelined with injury. Look at the players who played the other night against Edmonton that weren't on the opening night roster for Vancouver. I'm going to do it in numerical order, okay? Rathbone, Hauerlich, Highmore, VC, Hamonic, Grayovac, MacEwen, Boyd, Lind. That's nine players. You know, so they've gone through some big time changes, many of which have been required due to injury. So there's, you know, bringing a guy like Gadjevich coming up this week, then that right away is 10 that weren't here in January on opening night lineup. So I think that at the end of the day, whether it's the first game, the last game, the coach's job is to fill out a roster that gives his team the best opportunity to win. And like he has the last couple of nights, if he feels that young players like a Rathbone or a Lind or a Joleby or a Hoglund, or I know he goes without saying because he's played in every game, but I think you'll see more and more young players draw into more prominent roles here for this team as the season winds down.
Did we lose Joey? Joey.
I love those pregnant pauses, guys.
Well, that's a Larsh Cast special right there. So, Joey, I'll jump in here, and I just wanted to see, you know, we've talked a little bit over the course of the season with you about the Travis Hamonic signing. To me, I think he's been a pretty good fit. He has a stabilizing effect back there. He's probably the best closest replacement to a Chris Tanev. Do you think the Canucks are going to consider bringing him back next season? And if they do, does that have any implications on maybe a roster spot, like maybe Alex Edler not being a fit for this team moving forward? Or what are your thoughts on if Hamonic comes back and should they bring him back?
Yeah, you know, he's only played 30 of the 48 games this season for the Canucks. I think when he's been in the lineup healthy, that he's been a pretty good, effective player in both zones for the Canucks. Yeah, he's not known as an offensive defenseman, but he's been pretty good when in offensive situations, keeping pucks into the blue line, helping create scoring chances. But his bread and butter is being a good, steady, stay-at-home defenseman. And I think more often than not, they've seen that out of Hamonic. Remember, they got him late in the game in the summer when it came to signing free agents. Got him on a short-term deal. I think they'd like to have him back. Now, what that means for other players and other money that's available, we're going to find out. Yes, is Alex Edler going to turn another year older? Yes, he is. But they need guys to kill penalties, and arguably he's one of their best penalty killers. And I think it goes without saying that if Edler's to come back for another year, it will not be anywhere near the money that he's making. And hey, if somebody else in the league is going to offer him the same money he's getting right now, he'd be foolish to turn it down, even if it means for the first time ever not playing for an NHL team other than here with the Canucks. So among the many, many difficult decisions that the Canucks hockey off staff has to make coming up this summer, it'll be allocating funds on the blue line and what that means for guys like Hamonic and Edler, time will tell. But I think that with what he's done this season, when healthy, I think the Canucks would prefer to keep Hamonic here moving forward on their defense.
Absolutely. I think a lot of fans agree with you there. But anyway, so Joey, coming up next on Canucks Connected after the show or later on this afternoon, I mean, you have Troy Gamble you're talking to. There's an interesting story about his first game in the NHL, his debut game. So I want to play a clip that you provided for us. You posted on your Twitter feed if anybody wants to check it out again. But go ahead, Joel, tee up that clip for us.
I got the call and they said, hey, come to the rink, get your bag. I got on a plane from Medicine Hat to Calgary, Calgary to Edmonton. I went into my room and all of a sudden Stan Schmeal was there. I kind of woke him up from his nap. I don't know how happy he was. It was Tom Watt was their coach, and they were playing Wendell Young as the goalie. That's who I thought anyways. We go to warm up. I didn't take a shot, maybe a couple when he wasn't in the net. He took all the shots. I was up chit-chatting with Andy Moog up at the red line because we taught in a hockey school together. We go back into the locker room. So I go in and put gel in my hair. I had the mullet with spiky hair. And Tom Watt comes in and says, gamble in the twines. And I get up and I sprint to the washroom. And I think everyone thought I was puking. Well, I was trying to get the gel out of my hair because I didn't want it to burn my eyes. Because next thing I knew, I had to go play in this NHL game. And I was in over my head.
Oh, my God. That's so good. Joey, tell us about that. Break it down a little further. I mean, I think he was playing Gretzky and the Oilers that game.
Yeah, so that was at the time. Gamble, for our listeners that aren't aware, was a second-round pick of the Canucks in 86. Later that fall, he was back playing junior hockey in the WHL with Medicine Hat, and he got the call-up on a game day. We need you to come up here. We're playing the Oilers. So as you mentioned, he has that weird travel schedule, flying a small plane from the Hat to Calgary and then up to Edmonton, and he obviously prepares for a game. And it's against the powerhouse Dynasty Oilers team. And if you do a YouTube search and just type in Troy Gamble Canucks, the first video that comes up will be the highlights that he had from that game on Hockey Night in Canada. It was just an unbelievable night. It was the night that Wayne Gretzky scored his 500th NHL goal of his Hall of Fame career. Gamble talks about that. This is a player that not a lot of fans in today's generation know much about, but I'll guarantee you when you tune in today, he's profiled as his former defenseman, Doug Lidster. Troy Gamble is one of the best storytellers I've ever heard in hockey. I can't believe we haven't heard more from this guy in the past. He's had such an unbelievable life led both on and off the ice. He, outside of hockey, worked in the oil industry, guys. He still does. He lived in Northern Africa for 4 years in Libya.
Wow.
Like, he's got some unbelievable stories. So tune in at 3 o'clock this afternoon. Troy Gamble and Doug Lidster, our recent Canuck alumni guests, joining us on Canucks Connected.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for your time again, Joey Kenward, and we'll talk to you next week. Have a good
one. You got it, guys. Enjoy the game tonight, and enjoy your conversation up ahead here with honorary alumni, one of our best BC musicians, Aaron Brichette. I know he's set to join you guys. I look forward to that. Have a good show.
Can't wait. Thanks, Joey. Appreciate it.
That's going to be fantastic. It's funny, he says that, you know, mentioning Gretzky's 500th against Troy Gamble in his debut game. What kind of feels like a special night happening here. Don't you think? You know, McDavid's 100th.
Can we get Troy Gamble to play goal?
His 53rd game.
I was actually going to say, let's get McLean to strap on the pads for one more game. It's always.
We'll see what
maybe
happens.
Richard Brodeur, get him on the blower.
But anyways, you are all listening to the LarshCast here on Sportsnet 650 on a game day broadcast on the home of the Canucks.
I don't care who you are, because everybody's got a little dirt road in them. Yeah, you know.
Sportsnet Today with the Larsh Cast. Now here are your boys on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
All right, welcome back to the final segment of the Larsh Cast here on Sportsnet Today on May the 8th. And we just wrapped up an interview with Joey Kenward last segment. And we have a great interview coming up here in about 8 to 10 minutes.
So
with Aaron Brichette, a country star, a local country star. And I know Ryan's really stoked about this interview coming up. And we're going to get into a whole bunch of things Canucks related with him, as well as the country rocks music show festival that he helped organize. And Kirk McLean actually did bring this up on our show a few weeks back, and I think it's a very successful event. So we'll get
virtual,
into all that.
Virtual for the first time.
Virtual,
I think,
that's right.
Year, yeah.
Hopefully next year it won't be virtual.
Have you guys ever, you know, country music is obviously... You know, not my forte, but have you guys ever tried, was it karaoke or anything like going on stage trying to sing a country song? You get into
it.
Yeah, it's a great scene.
It's just fun.
Yeah.
It's happy feet beat music,
yeah,
man.
You get
exactly.
your twang on and it's
yeah,
so
you
good.
Do.
Oh, you got to get right in there and you got to throw, yeah, you absolutely got to
right
get that
on in.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, so before we do bring Aaron on, you know, there's a couple of hockey things we want to get to that we haven't had an opportunity to speak of on the show so far. So we did not really get into in the first segment on some of this, you know, the new news that came in last week with the NHL deal with TNT and Turner Sports. And there's something, you know, a lot of things brewing there with how the U.S. TV deals are going to go with ESPN back in the fold. And now we have Turner Sports. And I think the Score had a recent news article just that came out either last night or this morning about Wayne Gretzky possibly being linked to TNT, and
yeah,
because a little bit of a bidding war between ESPN and TNT.
He turned down, or ESPN was like, "How much money can we pay Gretzky?" Oh, we'll start off with a $2 million offer, and Gretzky's like, "Nope, I'm looking for five." And so they're like, "All right, we're gonna walk away from this." And yeah, TNT might step up and give Gretzky a $5 million contract to
That's
join
insane.
Them.
How are you gonna lowball Gretzky though? Come on,
yeah,
come
on,
lowball. Is $2 million a lowball offer? Come on!
It's Gretzky,
I mean,
man.
It's Gretzky.
Yeah, I guess we don't know what broadcasters all make in, you know, the elite tier. Like, what is BXM making? I don't know, but
dude,
yeah.
It's Wayne
five
Gretzky.
This is no Wayne Glensky, okay?
So, okay,
2,000 points in the NHL. Come on.
Yeah, but what has he done in broadcasting? Like, is Wayne Gretzky going to be a good broadcaster? And
he won't be doing play-by-play.
The reason they're getting him is because it's Wayne Gretzky. Like, they don't care what kind of a broadcaster he is. They're getting him because it's Wayne Gretzky.
Is Shaq a great commentator?
Yes,
Shaq is fantastic.
Absolutely.
Shaq and Charles Barkley are the best thing about the NBA on TNT.
They're
the best.
Sorry, was he good when he started? Fair enough. He's phenomenal
now. If we ever did live, like, you know, in studio or broadcast, me and Nav would be on opposite ends, like Shaq and Barkley, I think, for sure. Like,
oh, we would have to have a timeout button to mute you both for 5 minutes.
The best thing is
something.
When they don't talk about basketball, when they have their other stories, like Shaq about how what his strategies on filling gas. Like, have you guys seen that stuff? It's garbage, but right? But back it's so good.
Back to Gretzky, he would be he's a fantastic storyteller already, and I think he has done some color commentary in the past, and he was fantastic at that as well. I'm excited to hear his insights, because he has so many insights on the game. He's the greatest player to ever play, and so I think it's a win-win for hockey, for Turner Sports, TNT. Yeah. Sorry, ESPN, you know, the $3 million more offer might have brought you a bit more viewers, but I think a lot of people are going to be happy to have Gretzky back in the fold.
Disney, fork over the cash.
It's like Tiger Woods in golf. The game is better when Gretzky's involved.
By the way, just a side note, if TNT really wants to make this good, give Gretzky a Coach's Corner segment with Bill Burr. Because those two did like Real Sports like 5 years ago, and their chemistry is unreal. Bill Burr is a comedian, for those of you who don't know. Mm-hmm. Absolutely fantastic, hilarious dude. And him and Gretzky had really good chemistry on this one TV show they did together. So I think it could be fun, you know?
Wow. Yeah, when you started that, I had no idea that. I thought you were just throwing names together and Bill Burr was something you picked out of a hat, but I'm down for it.
No.
I'd watch.
No. Look, go out of your way to look it up on YouTube.
I'm gonna now.
Gretzky, like, they're pretty funny together.
Never question Joey the historian. Yeah. He's always
got the
facts.
This guy has learned more in his short 23 years than I have in my almost double time on
the
panel.
I got a question, though, for you guys.
Emphasis on
how,
short.
How is this ESPN and TNT, like, What is the strategy going to be? What should it be? Should it be more of a comedic take like the NBA does it, or should it be more serious?
Well, ESPN will do that for sure. I think ESPN is going
to
mimic what they're doing
it
with the
needs
NBA.
To be.
Can that work though with an
NHL? Yeah, it'll
thing?
Work. It needs to work. It's for the growth of the game of hockey. It needs to work. They need to show personality. They need to bring fans, like the modern day fan, the young fan, into the mix, not the older fans that are on their way out. I mean, nothing against the old fans, but we have our avenues of watching hockey and consuming all the any type of information that we want about the game. But the younger fans are the ones that you have to kind of capture and encapsulate their mindset and personas, and they have to have that ESPN on NBA or NBA and ESPN type of vibe to the game. I think it'll be good for them.
You know, and not only that, I mean, let's be honest, guys, like, we joke all the time about the traditional hockey players interview and how stoic everybody is. Like, I wonder what Connor McDavid's like in behind closed doors with his friends, because we see almost zero of his personality.
Have you seen his apartment? It's so bland. He's the same kind of person.
Dude,
outside.
Right. See, that's exactly it. This is a bland league. Players are trained. They're coached on how to be bland, how to not say anything inflammatory. So
did you see McDavid with the picture at the airport with that Filipino couple.
Oh man.
Just all over him, so excited, and McDavid looks like he's about to get tortured or something.
That's it, right? So that's the thing. The American market needs to see high energy. They need excitement. They need the flash along with the sizzle. They need a bit of comedy. They need some great commentary.
They need Ovechkin with the fiery stick celebration, right? That's what they need.
That stuff sells, man. You know, Sean Avery doing push-ups, as much as it drives the
I don't know about the on-ice crap, though. I don't want to see that in the game as much as.
But you know what? That's not wrong, TJ. There is a certain element of the showboating. Like, part of what people like about the NFL is the celebrations, all the ridiculousness. Like, I'm not saying, I agree with you, I'm not saying let players run wild, but why are we not in 2021 encouraging these players to show some personality? And
I think
every
the game,
time they do, we
I think the
them.
Game of hockey itself, the way it is played from the young level and the fundamentals, I don't think celebrations, individual celebrations, go over well in a very, very team-oriented game. Now, if you have imagine five players after one person scores a goal, instead of going by the bench and shaking everybody's hands, they do a little celebration together on the ice. It would look ridiculous. So I don't know. Football is different. There's 11 players aside and 53 on the roster. I mean, there's
the
more
football
room.
Ones are different.
There's more room for team celebrations, but in hockey, it's such a it's a different style of a team game, and I don't think it would work. But off ice, you know, like cabbie on, you know, on the street, whatever, like stuff that where you can show players' personalities. You know, ESPN might be able to do different style interviews. That would be great. But anyways.
Yeah. Well, and that's exactly it. You know, it's It's an interesting question, but you know, I think I hear that Aaron Pritchett is ready to come onto the show here. So without further ado, as a presentation of HBD Homes, let's welcome to the show for the first time on the LarshCast, Aaron Pritchett. Welcome to the show.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Well, we're doing pretty well. I think we're all certainly excited to have you on, not just because of the fact that you're a local music icon, but also a massive Canucks fan. And maybe that's where I want to start on first. Is I know that you grew up playing hockey in Kitimat, and you have mentioned before that you kind of wore your jersey or wore your uniform to bed all the time. Can you just talk about your process of becoming a Canucks fan and what it was like growing up being a fan of this team?
Yeah, I think I come by it pretty honestly, being a British Columbia boy my entire life. And when I was a kid, I used to listen to my little transistor radio. Yes, I'm that old. I had a little transistor radio under my pillow. And I was supposed to be sleeping, and I remember, you know, Stan Smeal score a goal, or Harold Snaps, or any of these guys that I looked up to and now get to, you know personally, which is cool. But when they'd score, I'd make a noise, and my mom would be yelling at me from downstairs, "Go to sleep!" And I'd be like, "The Canucks are playing. I can't go to sleep just yet." So, I was probably 7, 8 years old at the time, and it just was something that was ingrained in me. And when it came to playing hockey, I mean, there was no feeling that I could get from anything else at that age. Even learning how to ride a bike wasn't even as exciting as stepping on the ice and skating around and just that feeling of flying almost, you know, as a kid. And it was something that if I could have, I honestly would have loved to have been a hockey player more than even doing what I do now. And I know people think, oh, that's crazy, but honestly, I would have had more of a salary. But also hockey was my first love. My first true love was hockey. And I still have that to this day. And being able to play alongside these heroes of mine, because I'm a Canuck alumni member, is really a thrill. And even though it's been 5 or 6 years now since I got to have my Canuck alumni card, stepping out on the ice with these guys is literally, it's a dream come true and a real honor.
I can't even imagine what the excitement level would be on that. And you mentioned hockey is your first love. I would imagine that country is your second love. And you kind of mentioned before that the transistor radio, you've been doing this for a while now. So I've got to ask, as somebody who grew up in the glory days of the MTV, CMT, Much Music era, when you could actually see music videos on TV, what's the perspective from you, from a guy that made videos during that time and is now making videos in a largely Vevo and YouTube driven world? What's that change been like, and is, do you see value in music videos still to this day?
Well, you know what, to answer your last question first, I definitely see a huge value in shooting music videos, and I think it's so that people can put a face behind the music. And before music videos came out, yes, I was around before they really started, and MTV was brand new when I was a kid, and Much Music had just been developed when I was in my early teens, and man, it made a huge difference to be able to go, oh, that's what Motley Crue really looks like, or oh wow, that's Van Halen, and yeah, these guys really put on a show, and I want to go see their show. So I still think that's really important these days for people to be able to see not just what the artists look like, but, you know, give them a representation of what they might see when they get to go to a show one day after all this craziness is done. So, you know, with YouTube and Vimeo and all these outlets that allow us to put our music videos on, it's still really important for these artists to do that. And, you know, like getting into country, it put a face to what these country artists look like and what kind of show you would have expected from them. And yeah, I think it's super important that it still has to happen. And I do to this day. And I know the artists that I work with, I always push them. We need a video of some kind. And whether that means you shoot it on your iPhone or we actually do a big $20,000 production to it, whatever way, we got to get your face out there.
Yeah, no, I think it's hugely important still, and there's still tremendous value, and we're glad to see that you're still releasing videos. We are talking to Aaron Pritchett, country music superstar and Canucks alumni hockey player here on Sportsnet 650.
So one second, Ryan, we got to ask: is it Pritchett or Pritchett?
Pritchett.
You heard it different way.
It is Pichette. Okay, thank you. See, I did my research, boys, okay?
Yeah. I'm amazed you didn't say Pritchett or Pritchard. Or I've heard all the versions that I can't say.
I checked. That. I listened to you say it in some interviews to make sure, because I was 50-50. I was flipping the coin last night.
Aaron, if you think you have it tough, try Dollywall all your life.
You know what? I have. I've known Dollywalls and Randatwas and all kinds of amazing names you guys have. And yeah.
The best one I ever got was Diwali Wall, I have to say.
Ooh, happy Diwali Wall.
That's kind of cool, actually.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that. You're like a holiday at the same time. So, Aaron, I got to ask you, as a musician myself, obviously not on the same level, but are you looking for a rhythm guitar player? No, I'm just kidding. I just got to...
As a matter of fact...
You know, you only get one shot at that. But
just
actually,
in case
the real
you didn't
question...
know, Aaron, Ryan's middle name is No Shame.
No shame, none whatsoever. Yeah, absolutely. He's got two middle names.
Pregnant pauses his other one. So.
Yeah, but I got to ask about in 2008 when you signed to 604 Records. Most local musicians have either had a run in or have a story, good, bad, ugly, indifferent, about working with Chad Kroeger or Chad Kroeger's effect on the industry. I got to ask, as somebody who worked directly with them and released an album under that label, what was it like working with him and having his input on the songwriting process?
You know, it was actually really good. Chad's a really great guy. I mean, he and Nickelback sure take a beating when it comes to their music and their brand and everything. But I mean, he's a phenomenal writer, and for me to be able to go, okay, first of all, I get to sign under a label of a superstar, worldwide superstar, who has so much success and so much experience. When we were writing for that one album that we had with them called Thankful, there was a couple songs in there that I wanted to pass by him, and I never got to write with him per se, but he always had something to add that made the song make more sense. You know, it was starting to make sense, but it wasn't fully making sense. It didn't have a completion. And as soon as a guy like Chad gets a hold of a song, it's completed. And that was the coolest thing about being able to work with him. And yeah, of course you get to go, hey, I went to Chad's house and, skated on his rink and this kind of thing. But really when it came down to it, he added an element to my music at that time that it really needed and made it that much better and made it successful. So yeah. And all around, he's just a great guy. He is that guy that'll be like, hey, let's go downtown. We'll get a car to come pick us up. And we'll just go hang out downtown. But then I want to come back and write. And it's like, okay, I didn't expect that, but yeah. And we would, and it was a fun experience, but at the same time, it was a great learning experience from a guy like that, who's just nonstop, you know, thinking and always coming up with a song title or at least a hook area in the song that people are going to need to hear in order for them to believe in it. So yeah, it was great. Really great experience.
Good to hear.
All right, Aaron. Speaking of Nickelback and Chad, there's an Abbotsford connection there with Chad, and the Canucks made news this week with their intention of bringing their farm team over to Abbotsford. So do you have a personal connection to Abbotsford, and is there anything you can do to help maybe prop up that AHL franchise when it does get up and running?
As a matter of fact, yeah, I owned a house in Abbotsford for a number of years and lived there and kind of lived on the border of, you know, Langley, Aldergrove, Abbotsford for 25 years or so of my life and hold a strong connection with Abbotsford and know a lot of people there still. And when the Abbotsford Heat was playing and they were the Calgary farm team, like, why does Vancouver not take advantage of this situation, regardless of whatever the situation was, you know, the reasons why not at the time? It makes the most sense now, and this has to happen. This must be the case where Vancouver has their farm team in Abbotsford for the local economy, because it'll actually fill that rink every night, as opposed to seeing some of the games that I went to for the Heat that were, you know, just they really struggled. And it was because, it was Calgary's team. It wasn't our team. So this is huge. So I'm going to do everything I can in my power, whatever that means, to make sure that the team does come to Abbotsford and we get, you know, fans in that building every night.
It's going to be exciting for sure. And I think it was either Surrey or Abbotsford that were in the mix really in this area. And I think a lot of people are happy that it is Abbotsford. But going back to the Canucks Country Rocks concert here, so because we want to ask you all about that. It was virtual for the first time this year. But just take us through the whole experience this year and whether, you know, what was different about it, what you guys enjoyed, maybe what didn't work as well, what you missed, obviously the live fans and the audience there. But yeah, just take us through the experience this year and the alumni and how fun it was as well with all of them.
Well, I think we're adapting to everything that's been happening with COVID. And when it first happened, I thought, well, you know, for me personally, I'll do a little show on Instagram Live and just kind of keep my fans a little bit in the loop of what's happening with me personally, with my music. And then, you know, and basically everybody started doing that. All the artists did, some athletes did and started podcasts, obviously, and et cetera. But we adapted to the way we needed to entertain. So when I was approached by the alumni to do an online version this year, a virtual version of Canuck Country Rocks, I said, well, it totally makes sense. And we can set it up so that guys like Dallas and JoJo and, you know, some other ones could do, instead of just an at-home performance, we can have a venue, you know, where they could perform so it looks and sounds like these people are at a live show. They can kind of close their eyes for the 3.5 minutes of a song and feel like they're actually at a live venue. And they definitely were into that and figured that this is probably the best way we should do it is hold the virtual online version and then really plugging that we're going to be doing it live next year. And our numbers were phenomenal this year. And if we have to do it again next year, we're not afraid that, you know, that there's anything is going to suffer from it. And the charities that we raise money for will benefit from it like they did this year again. So it was a little different, a little tough. But at the same time, like I said, we've had this a year, sadly, this year experience of doing online already and virtual performances that it turned out pretty amazing. And looking forward to getting back next year and having, you know, being able to sweat on people from stage to shaking their hands in the front row. But for this year, I think everybody was pretty happy with the way it turned out. The Canuck alumni got to actually, you know, instead of being on stage, Kirk McLean hammering on a cowbell on stage this year, you know, he got to actually be interviewed and where people are sitting there listening to these really cool stories that they had. So all in all, it was great. Hopefully next year, like I said, live. And then, regardless, it was easy to maneuver this year just because of the experience that we've had from the last year.
Yeah, it's such an amazing cause, and we're so thankful to have you be a part of it. And I know Kirk McLean was sure proud of your involvement in this as well, too. We're unfortunately, I'd love to talk to you for another hour here if we could. I probably have 1,000 more questions I'd love to ask. But we are up against the clock here. So just wanted to say thank you so much for making the time to come on. And hopefully we can have you on maybe in the off season or next season when the Canucks are back playing again to talk some more about the team and your passions around it as well.
Absolutely. Anytime you want, and keep up the great work. I listen to you guys all the time.
Oh, that is about the biggest compliment we could receive. Thank you so much for being on with the Large Cast.
It's always on, I swear. You guys sound great.
Appreciate it. Awesome. Have a great one.
You too.
That was country music superstar and longtime listener of the Larsh Cast, apparently, Aaron Pritchett. We have been the Larsh Cast today. Thank you so much for sticking around and listening to us and for all of our guests today. Joey Kenward, Stacey Joe Rost. We had Aaron Pritchett on as well. And we also had Kraken play-by-play announcer John Forslund. Stick around. We've got much more Canucks content coming up in the lead up to the game today. And then, of course, we've got Connor McDavid in his quest for 100 points this evening against the Vancouver Canucks. So it's going to be an exciting game to watch, win, lose, or otherwise for the Vancouver Canucks. I'm Ryan for TJ, Sat, Joey, and producer Joel Gaudette. We've been the Larsh Cast on Sportsnet 650. Thanks for listening. I don't always have to crack me a cold one at 5 o'clock when the work day ends. And girl, I don't have to be holding you when the sun sets. But it's better.